Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
I was talking to the guy who wrote that piece of music last week, Mr. Rick Gilman. I said, you know, I even cut it down to 53 seconds, Rick, because it's kind of a long piece. And he goes, I know, I listened to the show. So there you have it. That, of course, is Buffalo Grass by Rick Gilman. That is the official music to the Writer's Block now. And we were so appreciative of Rick to giving that piece of music for the show. And turning over the copyrights to us, and it was just a grand gesture on his part. You are listening, of course, to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. This is Mr. Stuffy himself, Jim Christina, and of course, sitting over there in Fruta, Colorado, Mr. Richard Polinelli. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Jim. Yeah, you're Stuffy, and my head's trying to play some kind of drum solo. I don't know what's going on.
I've had a headache all day. You know, you've had days like that, right? Where you just don't know where it came from. It just came.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Miss Quirky from Albuquerque couldn't be with us. They had a death, and they had to take off and go to California for a funeral. So she'll be back with us next week. But right now, we're thinking of you, Bobby Jean. And let's see, a couple of announcements we have to make. Oh, yes, the big one. For those writers that rely on Amazon to print their books or publish their books, don't get comfortable. We submitted Caroline Giamanco's new book, Into the Night, and submitted it and resubmitted it and resubmitted it again for the third time. And Amazon still found fault with it when there was no fault with it. And they still haven't given me an answer, and that's been almost 2.5 weeks ago. I have actually asked them to pull it off the queue. They haven't even done that, so it's still up as in review. But the good news is that Caroline's book is now available. It is available on Lulu, and it is available on Amazon.
And Barnes & Noble.
And a lot of the other booksellers out there. So you can find Caroline's book. It's Caroline Giamanco. The book is called Into the Night. It's 427 pages or 28 pages. And it sells for $23.99. And you can pick one up from them. So there you have it. And Richard, you got an announcement to make? I'm sure you do.
Well, I'm gonna follow up on that a little bit. We are working on getting our website transitioned to where we will have our store where you can buy the books that we produce direct from us for a lot less than you're gonna have to pay to get them at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But right now, that's the only outlet we got. Give us a little bit of time. We'll have a nice little store up there. And then we can all tell Amazon what we really think of them, which is not repeatable on this show. What you're saying?
Well,
something.
it is repeatable, but we won't.
We won't.
Yeah, because we still have books available on Amazon, and I don't want to lose them. So.
Well, that is true. And I also have a book I am trying to wrap up, and it will go the same route through Lulu when we're done. It's the sequel to Escaping Infinity.
Right.
It is an anthology. There are going to be 8 stories, which I thought was, kind of fitting considering what the symbol for infinity is, being sideways, sideways 8. But it's an interesting collection of stories, and it serves as the second book in the Infinity series, and it kind of sets the table for next year's third book, which I need to finish getting writing done on, so I can release it next year on time. But that's pretty much what I'm up to. So you can look for Exploring Infinity to come out probably in about 2 weeks.
Excellent. Excellent. And as always, this show is brought to you by Tuscany Bay Books and Black Dog Publishing. And for those new writers out there, actually old writers too, that are looking for a new home for their volumes and their books, give us a shot. Give us a call. Give us a holler. Give us an email. Give us something. And we'll talk to you about getting your book published and edited and proofread and whatever it is that it takes. Sorry, Mike, we don't do 972-page books, but hey, everybody's got a deal. Anyway, tonight's guest, a returning guest, actually a man who spent a lot of time working for our government. He was in intelligence, and he's been on the ground, in the air, in the water. He's been just about everywhere that a guy could be. The book that we'll be talking about briefly tonight is a very big takeoff from what he is usually writing about. So please welcome back to the Writer's Block, the one and the only, the spy master himself, Mr. Michael Bond. Hello, Mike.
Well, hello, guys. Thank you very much, Jim, and thank you, Richard, for the invitation. It's delightful. Sorry Bobby isn't there, but pass on my best wishes, and I'm delighted to be with you guys on a lovely evening in the end of August.
Well, it is, and it's actually cold here in the mornings now. It's like in the 40s, because I'm in Idaho, yeah. And Richard's in Colorado, and you're in Vermont, aren't you?
I'm Maine right now, Jim.
Oh, Maine. Okay. Maine. Yeah.
And it's we're having a heat wave after a very cold summer, But it's, the more, boy, I tell you, when fall comes, it comes with a bang out here in Maine, and then you get 9 months of winter.
Well, we are.
Anyway, thanks so much for the invite. Yeah, please.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know, we read your book. It's the first novel is called America. It's one of seven, I believe, is that you're going to wind up with that and finally when you're done. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a series of seven novels in addition to the nine novels that I've already published.
And, right. This book is set against the early 1960s, early to mid 1960s, during the time of the Kennedy assassination and the civil rights movement and the start of the Vietnam War. And oh my gosh, there's just so much going on. And that's my time. I was, 1961, I was 11. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was around.
Time to see it all from a distance. In a way.
Well, actually, I saw it pretty much right close up. My dad was in the Air Force, and we saw it every week when he came home. He used to be an instructor at the West Point or at the Air Force Academy.
Wow!
And he used to fly into Miramar every weekend, gunfighter. Yeah, and La Jolla, and because we lived in Del Mar, and he would come home on weekends, and he actually got to fly a T-38 home every weekend, which was really kind of cool. But we saw everything going on pretty much firsthand.
Wow! Well,
so
the fact in the first volume of America that you were just mentioning, the Air Force Academy has a major place in the book,
right?
This was right after the Air Force Academy moved out of its first digs in Denver and moved down to Colorado Springs,
right.
Right, right. And it was also the year of the big cheating scandal Academy. Yeah, what 65 got thrown out, yeah. But anyway, it was quite a time. And it was, in a way, from the end of the 1950s through the 1960s was the most tumultuous time, I think, in America, certainly until today's miseries.
Today's misery, for sure. But this takes into four young people, Troy and Tara and Daisy and Mick.
Yep.
And they are they're quite the conglomeration of young people. I mean, Troy is he's orphaned, and he's trying to figure out how to deal with the new family. Excuse me. Mick's a football player.
Yep. And a rebel,
Daisy's his chick. Of course, that's what we didn't say girlfriend. We said chick. Yeah.
Yep.
And
she goes on. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead. And Tara, of course, is Troy's new sister with a new family that he's got, and so they all kind of it's their own pathways that they choose in the first part of this. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, in the entire novel, it's quite interesting. And this is definitely a takeoff from what you normally write, because you're normally in the spy genre or espionage somewhere or terrorism or something. And this one is kind of a different takeoff, and it's a lot gentler novel than we're used to reading from you.
Well, I'm sorry about that, dear. Be with. I'll try to do better. No, this is a novel that I've been wanting to write, in fact, ever since I kind of, a lot of it is about the place in rural New York where I grew up till I was 10, which was basically dairy farming and very rural, yet we were close to Manhattan. And it was the fact that things changed so quickly in the 60s, as you were mentioning earlier, makes it very fertile ground for examination of what the United States is and was, and how people grow up and how you face challenges and complexities in life.
Absolutely.
As well as how do love relationships evolve or don't evolve, and what I tried to do, in essence, I've been trying to write or thinking about this book since basically the 1960s. And what happened too, Jim, is in my mind, there's not a single historical novel that reflects this whole period in American history, starting in the late 1950s and going through the 60s, Vietnam War, civil rights, as you mentioned, rock and roll, the complete liberation of sex due to the pill, and all of these amazing drugs that suddenly appeared and substantially changed people's minds in many ways for the better.
Well, it certainly altered their perspective of things, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. And what I'm going to do in the succeeding novels is I'm going to take them right up to the present, right up to somewhere in the 2020s. So we're going to be able to see this whole evolution of America over 70 years, and also to watch these people grow from youth into old age, and to see how long-term relationships mature and alter. So it's basically an examination of life itself, as well as of our country and the world. A lot of the book takes place all over the world, in North Africa, Asia, you name it, and of course,
sure.
That was kind of what the goal was, to give people a real sense of what it was like to live there. And I mean, the book's doing astoundingly well, and a lot of people are saying, "Oh boy, you have reminded me of what it was like."
Well,
other people are saying, you know, I was too young for that, but boy, I'm glad I read your book and now I see what it was like. So it's a fun subject and one that certainly needs to be read. Yeah.
Did you find writing this first novel, America, did you find it somewhat cathartic for you?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. A lot of the book is me. And you know, the four main characters, in a sense, each of them is me. The major protagonist, Nick, who's a, as I said, a football hero, but also he challenges everything, and he turns against the war as the war develops and becomes
right.
a major leader against the war. And then Troy, his adopted brother, ends up in the Air Force Academy, and we follow him in that life.
And
the sister Tara goes from being a classical pianist and on her way to Juilliard, and then gets into blues, Delta blues, and from
right.
there into soul and rock and roll. And so, and I'm a guitarist too, so like that's her. And all my life, I've wanted to understand how the brain operates and how what the mind is. And so, the fourth person, Daisy, ends up in following that path, becoming a scientist at Stanford, and And again, at the time when U.S. universities had done over 5,000 peer-reviewed analyses of the effects of psilocybin and other hallucinogens on the human brain, and much of it was very positive. And so I'm unearthing a lot of that research too. So it's all going into giving somebody a complete as much as possible
sure.
of what that whole period was, to be followed by other periods leading up to now.
Sure. Hang on just a second, Mike. We're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll be right back with you. You are listening to The Writer's Block on LA Talk Radio, and we'll be right back with you right after this brief word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says be a host, and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say, and if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com, and listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back with our guest, Mr. Mike Bond, and Richard Polinelli, and myself. And if you want to call and talk to Mike, you can. The number in the studio here is 323-203-0815. And again, write it down, 323-203-0815. And you can call and you can talk directly to Mr. Mike Bond, and you can get an earful because the man knows what he's talking about. You know, I found this, having read a couple of your other books, Mike, and this one, I mean, as I already said, it was somewhat, well, a lot different than your other novels. But one thing you did keep on doing and you're very good at is character development and descriptive places and things without using a lot of, without being too wordy. And I really enjoyed that about your writing. And I have to say that your character development in this book was as good or better than some of the other stuff we read by you.
Well, thank you. That's always the goal. And what the easiest way I've found to do that, Jim, is to kind of meet your character. You don't tell your character what to do. You meet them. They come into your head or they come into your mind, and they slowly take on. It's like when you meet a person for the first time, you may have some good clues about them and what they're like, but you don't know them deeply. But as you get to know them over time, your understanding expands and becomes much more refined. And I think that's what happens with my characters. I meet them and then I let them go and try to describe what they say and what they do.
Right. Do you find, and Richard and I have found this to be true as well, that your characters oftentimes dictate which way your book is going to go?
Yeah, I think so. I don't start out with an outline and that I try to hew to exactly. I mean, I had no idea, for instance, in the first book that once Troy was unable to fly fighter planes after his time with the Air Force Academy because his vision had gone bad and he went into the Marines. You know, that was his choice. I love the Marines, but, I let my folks make their own choices. And it drives a much more interesting narrative, I really think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Richard?
Yeah, I'm kind of the young one in this conversation, which is kind of nice because I don't often get to say that. I showed up shortly after Kennedy's assassination. So your second book sounds like you're going to start getting into that area where I can actually kind of relate more to what was going on. You mentioned that you're going to bring your characters all the way up into the 2020s. And I'm sitting here trying to figure out how Mick is going to survive that long, because that man's diving into caves and walking out in the desert with no water. Did he kind of come to you that way, or is that something that developed as you were developing the character, that he would be that kind of a adventurous spirit that would go out and do these crazy things and go, man, I better not do that again, and then turn right around and do it again?
Yeah. Well, that's me. I mean, a lot of that was just it's not purely autobiographical in that one of the things you do in the covert world is you never make anything exactly like the person is, because you don't want the person to get caught and killed. So, but that Nick's whole personality and all of his adventures, almost all of them are precisely ones that I went through at that period. You know, the being caught in the Sahara, you know, he goes on, he gets up in the Himalayas, he gets in a number of different wars. And I think if you, one of the things I try to do, if I could back up with you, is that I always try to write about what I've been, where I've been, and what I've done. In other words, if I describe a street in a book, you can be darn sure I've been on that street. I don't make things up. So
right.
Not making things up makes it a lot easier for the reader to have a sense that this is real and this is something that I could learn from as well as enjoy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that was kind of another thing I wanted to ask you, and you kind of answered it already, was is it just Mick that you did that with, or is it some of what Troy's getting into, and even Tara and Daisy? Is there things that you experienced or that you witnessed others going through that you worked into this? Because these four kids, I mean, they're like into everything and doing everything, and you kind of wonder how in the world somebody could have that much time and energy to do these things.
Well, I think when you're young too, you have more energy. And yeah, all four of the characters, I suppose, represent as well parts of my own experiences. Is Tara, for instance, the musician. I mean, I played guitar for God 55 years, I guess, since I was little. And you know, that has been a long-term passion of mine, particularly rock and roll. I mean, hard blues and rock and roll. And Daisy, as I said earlier, the one who goes into brain research, that's where I thought I was headed after college. And I'm still fascinated. I still read brain science journals all the time. Mm-hmm. And again, with Troy, who went to the Air Force Academy, and he couldn't, he finally had to realize, back then, if you couldn't fly planes unless you had 20/20 or 20/10 vision.
Right.
And
right.
That was exactly what happened to me. I was slated to go to the Air Force Academy my senior year of high school. My eyes went crazy. And, you know, they didn't go crazy, but I went from 20/10 to, I don't know, 20/30, 20/40. And I realized I wasn't going to be able to fly fighter planes, and that was when I changed gears. So all four of these major characters are, a lot of the experiences they have are ones that I had. For instance, Daisy goes down to Mississippi to help in the voting drive in 1965 and works with a guy named Al Lowenstein, whom I worked with very closely in a number of civil rights and related issues when I was quite young. So all of these people are part of me, and they're all individual people. And Nick's approach to everything in life was, if that's a tree, run at it and hit it with your head, see if you can knock it down.
Yeah.
That was kind of my approach to life.
Mick is doing a lot of travel in this first book. And I was kind of struck by the fact that you could back then pick up and go to Timbuktu or, you know, wherever you wanted to go. And it wasn't a big deal and you didn't need a whole lot of money. And you compare that to now, and it's a royal pain in the neck to get anywhere. Not to mention you got to rob a couple of banks to finance the thing. So how is that going to change as the series goes? Are you going to kind of reflect that, the change in accessibility and travel?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of my youth, I mean, when I was doing this kind of stuff, at one point I got a bunch of stamps on my passport, and the idea was to hitchhike from Paris to Nepal, and you had to go in order to do that, which I did most of. You had to go obviously down through Italy and across to Greece, and then you had to go through Turkey, which at that time was not fundamentalist Muslim like it mostly is now. And the next thing you know, you're in Iraq, and then you're crossing Iran, and you're going through Afghanistan, you know, over the Hindu Kush into Pakistan, and all of that. People were nice, people were friendly, you were in danger. Islamic fundamentalism hadn't reared its ugly head yet, so people were once more open. And yeah, I mean, I lived for 4 months on the road one time on $400.
Yeah,
and that's a little hard to do now.
Yeah, my first solo trip, I was 17, and I was all over the Northeast. And I think really? I may have had like $150 on me when I left. And I think I got home with about 30 of it still. And I had no clue when I went, where I was going to stay, what I was going to do. But for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. I just kind of roamed around. And if you think I would let my kids or my grandkids pull a stunt like that now, you're nuts.
Nope. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, what I found was kind of unique is that you mentioned a couple programs that Kennedy put into existence. One was the Peace Corps, and the other was VISTA, which was the domestic Peace Corps.
Right,
and a lot of kids or a lot of people who are reading your materials now would not have any idea what those two programs were. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say they were developed by Sergeant Shriver, Maria Shriver's father, and they were absolutely 100% humanitarian.
Definitely, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote this book as a historical novel, because I one of the good things about a novel is Albert Camus said. Fiction is a lie that tells the truth. And this is really what I want to do, is to bring people so deeply and closely into this period that they understand these things. And I remind them of what Kennedy was like. I remind them of his speeches, of how he beat Nixon and Eisenhower versus Stevenson. And in the following books, I'm going to get a lot more into national politics, because I was been very active. I was a senatorial candidate in Montana, and then went on to be very involved in national politics. So, including significant roles in two different presidential campaigns. So I want everybody to understand this whole thing, what America was like in this whole period, because we're in such tragically bad shape now. That if we can understand where we've come from, maybe we can heal ourselves.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. You know, when I was finishing college, I was going to be a history teacher, and part of my deal was that I wanted to teach history backwards. I wanted to start modern times and then go back, and you start really with the cause, and then wind up with the effect instead of vice versa.
Yeah.
So that way kids can assimilate with it, but. No.
Sure. That's a great idea. I wonder if you could write a book that way.
You probably can. You can write a book any way you want.
Yeah, you would have to be all flashbacks and stuff like
exactly.
that. Maybe just time travel, you know, who's to say? I've been going back in time.
There's an idea.
Yeah. I'm delighted. And you asked earlier, Jim, about, you know, why is this such a different path, as it were, from some of my other novels. I've always, used writing to illuminate a situation which needs to be rectified. One of my books had to do with a leakage of nuclear materials and the dangers that had. Another one of my thrillers had to do with CIA death squads in Central America. And another one had to do with fighting the elephant poachers in Kenya. Wherever there's a major situation that's a tragedy, I try to write about what it's all about from the point of view as if the reader were there. And that's what people say. I felt like I was in your book. I felt like I was there. And that's once you have the reader feeling they were there, then they have an emotional response to the history. It isn't just something drawn
exactly
on a piece
exactly
of paper, and they remember it as if it was their own life.
Well, you can relate to it.
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. Totally. Hang tough just a second here, Mike. We're going to take another real quick break, and we'll be back with you in just a minute. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block. We will be right back with you right after this brief message from Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books.
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published, and right now we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we are back in the studio with our guest tonight, Mr. Mike Bond, and of course Richard in Colorado, and myself in Idaho. And we are talking about Richard's book, America, and we're going to switch gears here in just a minute. And if you want to call and talk to Mike, number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And again, that number is 323-203-0815. Okay, Mike, let's talk a little bit about your process.
A lot of it is instinctive. It really is.
If you're like Richard and myself, we know the first chapter, we know the last chapter, and have no idea what the middle is going to be.
There you go. Yep, that's a good way to look at it.
Well, you know, that's...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
I was just going to say, I found that there's a real benefit to you discovering the plot, you discovering what's happening at the same time the reader does. In other words, first you discover it, and then you describe it as exactly as you can.
Right.
As profoundly, as simply as you can. And then let the reader discover it. But first of all, we writers have to discover it. Makes for very interesting work, anyway.
It does. It does. When is your very favorite time to write? I mean, a lot of people, I like writing in the early morning. Mostly that's because we have Tuscany Bay book duties during the day, and we have to read a book a week for this show. So we really don't have a lot of time to write. So I usually do my writing like between 4 and 6, 4 and 7. Hopefully I get some done during the week. What is your favorite time?
To do it. I'm all over the map. Yeah. I mean, it depends also, it depends what kind of night you've had. I mean, like lately, since this thing in Kabul started, I've been not sleeping. It's just brought back all the PTSD anybody could ever hope for. And when I don't sleep at night, I tend to either get up real early, as you suggested, and work, or I do other things related to books. And then when later in the day, I tend to write. I also write a lot in the late afternoon, before dinner. I think my brain thinks, well, day's almost over, you better get writing. And it's inconsistent. So I don't really have a constant pattern.
Okay, that's fair. You know, that's totally fair.
Yeah. I often write 6 to 8 hours a day, and often 7 days a week. Week after week. So I even if I'm inconsistent in what it is, I'm at it a lot of the time.
Where's your favorite place to write?
When I was young, as I mentioned, in America, and I was a student when I was 19 at a university in France, in Aix-en-Provence, and there's a beautiful big cathedral in Aix-en-Provence called the Cathedral of Saint-Sauveur. And I was a mountaineer at the time. I was a rock climber. So I would put a couple of books and some writing paper or something and a bottle of water in my little backpack, and I would climb the tower of the cathedral. and which was nearly fatal. I mean, it was a stupid thing to do. But I get up there, and there was a little room at the top, and I could sit there in the sun and read Camus and watch the people go by way down below. It was a, that was my favorite place I've ever worked and written.
But you're not there anymore.
I like my office, and I write for a while, and I walk around, come back in, and write some more. And I spend a lot of time in the woods, so I don't try to write in the woods. It's too difficult, you know. I can't say I love to write. I have to write. It's not a question of choice. And, you know, the other thing that's really drives me is the knowledge that, at least for me, and it seems most of us, I don't understand much about life. I have no idea what we are, where we're going, where we came from. To my mind, most of us don't. And there's so many mysteries associated with living. And what happens when we die? I mean, are we gone or is there something left? How do we structure our relationships so that the human race can most benefit, or that we can most benefit? So I'm very much focused on mystery, and there are so many mysteries. When you come right down to it, we really don't know much at all about life. We have a lot of opinions, and we have a lot of theories, but we don't know much. And so that's the mystery I'm tackling all the time in my writing.
Do you find that PTSD helps you write or hinders your writing?
That's a good question. And the thing is, it does both. Like, I've had just raging PTSD since the whole Kabul thing started. I mean, I consider this the most atrocious, most atrocious bad misstep in a long time. And militarily, it's disgraceful. So, whereas PTSD, sometimes it drives me because I'm trying to exercise these things. You know, I'm trying to exercise, get rid of this. And if I can put it into a combat scene, or if I can, in a book, or if I can put it into what it's like to look at the wife you love as you leave the house and know it's probable you might not ever come back. Those kind of things can be a strong driver. And particularly in my war books, like Assassins, which is mostly about Afghanistan and Iraq, I'm driven. After 9/11 is when I started I started Assassins, and I was absolutely driven. It was the only way I could keep sane, because I knew all the things we'd done wrong, and I knew that we should have known about the Al-Qaeda and everything before we did, and I knew with how G.W. Bush had absolutely screwed everything up. So, you know, you also write to rectify, to get rid of falsehoods, to bring out the truth, because if we don't know the truth, we're lost. And today, I don't think most of America has the faintest idea what's going on.
No, they don't want the truth. Yeah. They want a convenient truth.
Well, I think that's kind of a interesting parallel between Vietnam, which is the time that we're talking about in your book, and now, is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. We've got Vietnam and Afghanistan have been screwed up by political leadership, right? I think we would all agree with that. So, but and our political leadership doesn't seem to get the memo. This didn't work last time. Why are we doing it again?
Yeah, isn't that Einstein's version, definition of insanity?
Yeah.
Doing things over and over again that don't work. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, our entire political class needs to be fired. What has happened with this bunch in the White House is they have so completely destroyed the faith of the rest of the world in our country in such a short time. In a real world, or if we had moral people, then all would resign. But no, they're going to keep going. So we have to find a way to ourselves better run our politicians. We can't leave them to do what they want, because all they care about is glory. You know, the politicians are not in office more than a few months, and she or he starts thinking about their legacy.
Yeah.
What can I do so I can stand out in history? You know, how many people do I have to let die that way? Anyway, so, yeah, we really need to substantially, I believe, just following up on what you said, Richard, we need to fundamentally reduce the power of government over ourselves. And, you know, 40% of all the world's military budgets are spent by the United States, and we're 11% of them. Population of the world, and we're not even 11%. So there's a terrible anomaly there that needs to be rectified, and we have to. You know, I talked in several of my books, and I'm going to bring it up again in the America series, that the invasion of Iraq, the two invasions of Iraq by the Bush father and son, were both extremely illegal and fraudulent and based upon lies. And we have done more to destroy the Middle East in the last 50 years, you know, mostly at the behest of the oil companies. You know, we used to throw elected governments over any time that one of our oil companies was having trouble getting that government to sign a lease. You know, we just go in and turn the government upside down and get what we wanted. So All that has to change. And I write about what really went down in those last years and all the way up to the present. I'm not going to leave any sins uncovered, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny. You brought that up. I was thinking the other day, I was talking with a friend, and we're like, the British tried to go into Afghanistan. That didn't work. The Russians went into Afghanistan. That didn't work. We go into Afghanistan. That clearly didn't work. You know, at some point, can we just leave that country alone? Because it doesn't seem to work.
Yeah. Well, the sad thing is now that we have, not only have we generated a whole new generation of fantastically insane terrorists, we have provided them with the arms of a large modern country. And I mean, when I said $50 billion worth of helicopters and Humvees and over 1 million freshly made and unused rifles. Do you know what damage those crazy bastards can do with that? And they will. You know, today's slaughter of the American Marines, which is so atrocious, that's going to be nothing compared to what's coming down the path.
Well, that's true. That's true. Well, I had a comment the other day. I was telling the bookie, that's my wife, Jerry. She's the one that booked you on the show, actually.
I've talked to Jerry a couple times in the past.
And I said, you know, if you want to get rid of the Taliban, now's a good time to do it because they're all in Kabul. Just put a whole bunch of troops on the ground and surround the city.
I like my suggestion better.
Take them out one at a time.
No. It's really simple. Get everybody that we want out. Let them all be there, and then drop one of those, the mother of all bombs? Boom.
Yeah.
One shot. Yeah. It's all done.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't want to get rid of the Taliban because they provide us the war revenues.
There you go.
At any rate, Hank, we got one more commercial to do, and then we'll be back with you. You are listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block, and we will return in just a moment, right after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity. Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know, there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge. Yes, it's true, and no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market, offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And we are back. We are back with our guest, Mr. Mike Bond, and of course, Richard and myself. And, geez, we only got like about 5 minutes left, Mike. This show has flown by.
So
well, you guys are really, really raised a lot of very interesting questions.
Well, thank you. I mean, we try. You know, you mentioned, I mean, yeah, you mentioned you've been living with PTSD. I did too for a lot of years, and I have to say that is very uncomfortable. You doubt, not so much the shirking and the ducking and, you know, but it's a constantly questioning yourself. And I found that to be the hardest part. Unworthy. Yeah. Feeling less than anyone else on this street, the feeling of worthlessness, I think, was the hardest one. And you know, I finally decided to just put it away, but it still rears its head occasionally, but not too often anymore.
Well, that's good, because it can ruin your life, obviously. And I know many
definitely
will. There are many veterans who have completely damaged lives, obviously. You don't go through what a lot of the Marines and Army went through in Vietnam, for instance, or the Navy SEALs, for instance, or Iraq. I mean, the IEDs, the prominence of IEDs in Iraq and Afghanistan created
right.
a whole new type of PTSD. And, you know, you're standing there with your best friend's brains on your face. And,
right.
you know, you don't ever come back from that. And,
right.
Or you're standing there looking at the body of a young woman who's been burned alive with gasoline because she didn't want to marry some old man. You know, that happens all the time in these Muslim countries. And I was telling an ex-Marine today that, you know, they used to once a week in the soccer stadium in Kabul, they used to have a stoning day, and they would stone young women to death who had refused to marry whom the mullah wanted them to marry. And, you know, they bury the woman up to her waist in dirt, and then guys stand around at a certain distance and throw stones at her till she's dead. And so, you know, you don't have to see much of that before it stays with you all your life. And for me, it's worst in the middle of the night when I start to go to sleep, and then I'm suddenly
yep.
back in it. I wake up, and I don't know where I am, and I think I'm in danger, and then I realize...
Right.
You know, I woke myself up snoring.
When I lived in Tacoma, I used to go to the Tacoma Vet Center, and we had a group of guys that we put together that would go and talk to veterans, talk them down. The cops would call us if they had a veteran in a house that was being abusive or wouldn't leave, and they would call us to come and talk to them. And we talked more than one guy out of the house.
That's
hard.
I'm sure it is.
Well, they don't have any idea what they're doing. They have no clue.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and then you mix that with amphetamines or some other crazy
or
drugs.
Or alcohol.
No, alcohol is really bad. Oh, yeah. And, I mean, I've helped a lot of buddies who've been worse than me. It's a brotherhood. It's an absolute brotherhood.
Absolutely.
And it does.
I'm going to apologize. We are out of time. If you wouldn't mind, give our listeners your contact information, please.
Yeah, sure, I will. And it's my website is mikebondbooks.com, all one word, Mike Bond Books. And there's a contact link there, and you could contact me. I get contacted a lot by people, and I always respond within a day. And,
excellent.
So I'd love to hear from anyone who would like to get in touch and talk more about whatever the things that you guys and I have been talking about or whatever else. We're all in this together, you know?
We are. So it's all one big world. That's for sure.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. I know it's late there, so go grab yourself a beer and relax.
Okay.
Take care, my friend.
Richard, thank you both very much. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.
Bye-bye. And next week we have Joan Elliott, who will be joining us right here in the Little Writer's Block. And Bobby Jean will be back with us next week. And it'll be a fun week. And thank you, Richard.
Thank you, sir. You know, we're going to start calling her, because Albuquerque is the Duke City. We're going to start calling her the Royal Quirkiness.
Oh, your royal quirkiness.
The royal quirkiness.
Okay, that's good. Actually, make a sign and hold it up on the screen.
I will do so.
Okay. For Richard, myself, and Bobby Jean, who couldn't be here, for the bookie, who does amazing job of keeping the slots filled on Thursdays, and, of course, Mr. Sam Hassan, the owner and operator of LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.